I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Earlier this spring, the Justice Department instituted a zero-tolerance policy at the U.S.-Mexico border, prosecuting adults entering the country illegally and putting their children in shelters, in tents, cages, and empty Walmart. It's estimated that more than 2,000 children have been separated from their parents in the last 6 weeks. The pictures of crying and confused migrant children are heartbreaking, and the ProPublica audio tape of children calling for their parents is devastating. The administration says this policy, this crackdown, has been instituted as a deterrent. The president said yesterday the U.S. will not be a migrant camp, a refugee holding facility. Here's the head of the Department of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, speaking on Monday.
We do not have the luxury of pretending that all individuals coming to this country as a family unit are in fact a family. We have to do our job. We will not apologize for doing for our job. We have sworn to do this job. This administration has a simple message. If you cross the border illegally, we will prosecute you.
The Washington Post reported, using numbers from the Department of Homeland Security, that in the first 5 months of 2018, there were 191 cases of individuals using minors to pose as fake family units. That's out of some 31,000 families apprehended at the border, less than 1%. We asked Julian Aguilar to join us. He's border affairs and immigration reporter from the Texas Tribune. And Julian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, any questions or comments, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Julian, describe this tent city for us. It's about 20 miles from El Paso. It's called Tornillo. We've seen pictures of it, but describe what this tent city entails.
Well, it's sort of somewhat still a mystery. I mean, the government, like they did with the processing center in McAllen over the weekend, they released some photographs of what it looks like inside. And, you know, it looks like a big camp. You know, it's got cafeteria-style tables, and it's got bunk beds, and it's got some recreation areas outside, soccer fields in particular. But aside from the congressman from this area, United States Representative Will Hurd, a Republican, and the Democratic state lawmaker from that area, Mary Gonzalez, I don't know of anybody else that's actually gone in to tour the facility. That could change because DHS is obviously getting a lot of heat and a lot of requests to actually see firsthand what's going on. But apparently this facility holds unaccompanied minors, according to the government, that are older, teenagers. But Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who represents the adjacent county here in El Paso, he said he was told on Sunday that about 20% of the people in there were labeled unaccompanied minors because they had been separated. But, you know, in all fairness, State Representative Gonzalez said that there's running water, it's air conditioned, they have counselors and caseworkers on site, and they have a medical room there as well. So it seems like inside the conditions are fairly humane. Now, the Border Patrol released some pictures of the processing center in McAllen, way downriver from El Paso, Texas, and some of those conditions, I think, were people that were received with a little bit more criticism just because of the high fencing and the cages. You know, we think smaller areas, but sure, these are, in fact, you know, cages by definition because they are erected, you know, secured by fences, and these kids are, you know, waiting inside.
I'm curious how quickly this Tornillo, how quickly this tent city, can we call it that, how quickly that went up?
Yeah, right. That's another, criticism that the local lawmakers are lobbying toward the government, because by this time, just this time last week, Tuesday, there was a press conference here in El Paso in front of the federal courthouse where lawmakers and advocacy groups were expressing concern about erecting a tent city at Fort Bliss, the big army base that's here in El Paso County. And 48 hours after that, the government had confirmed Tornillo was instead the place. And so lawmakers were asking questions, asking what a timeline was. And by Friday afternoon, I spoke with one lawmaker, State Representative Cesar Blanco, a Democrat from El Paso, that said he was blindsided because it was up and running already. So these are erected pretty quickly. I think people are also hoping they can be torn down pretty quickly, but that's some more of the buzz about this one out here in West Texas, that it could actually expand to hold not hundreds but thousands of unaccompanied minors if that's deemed necessary.
Who's running this tent city?
The Federal Department of Health and Human Services is the lead agency in charge of this. That's according to lawmakers in a fact sheet. You know, they're in charge of sort of doling out duties, but the Health and Human Services is the lead agency that's charged with overseeing this. With respect to processing and the legal immigration sort of maze that these kids have to run through, I'm almost certain that that's what these caseworkers and government officials, other government officials, are on hand for. But the overall operation and the well-being, we're being told, is under the purview of HHS.
Help us understand, and I think because we're so far from you, we probably don't understand some of the things that are happening at the border, who enters legally, who enters illegally. There are ports of entry, is that correct, where people can go, seeking asylum?
Several ports of entry, sure. And asylum laws, it's very tricky. I'm no attorney, so I just know general things, descriptions. You can present yourself at the port, and that's one way to seek asylum, or you can find a way to enter legally with a visa or a tourist visa of some sort and go to an asylum officer. It's less confrontational. But, yes, and that's another thing that emerged over the last few days, is the DHS secretary is saying, look, come to the ports, come legally, and we're not going to separate you. But there have been stories where that hasn't been the case. And the government says that, you know, generally the families will stay united unless there's a reason to believe that the parent or guardian is not, in fact, the parent or guardian, or if there's an imminent threat to the child, or if the person is deemed inadmissible from some sort of previous criminal offense. And they could obviously add to that list. This is only what the secretary has been saying. But what the thing that the government, I don't think, is conceding to is the fact that they actually station CBP officers in the middle of the bridge before people can make it to the U.S. side, and they ask for documents there. I've seen this firsthand here in El Paso. I saw it yesterday, where there was a family from Mexico that was waiting about 20 feet south of the U.S. side of the binational watermark that turns into U.S. soil, where agents were there asking for documents, and they had been told that the processing center was full and for them to come back later. So this, in fact, is a deterrent, I think, because if they're being sent back from the port of entry and they're still desperate to come to the United States somehow, then the only option is to come between the ports, which is what the government official says is the crime that people are being separated from their children for.
And just to underscore what you just said, it's a misdemeanor crime, and it has been for decades, for people to enter the U.S. border without a visa or some kind of authorization. What's new is this policy, and my understanding is this is not a law. This is a policy coming from the Trump administration that is separating immigrant families at the border. And they might not be coming through ports of entry, so they are coming here illegally, but they are being separated, and this is new. Is that your understanding as well?
That is. That's the big sea change from when the unaccompanied minors and family units began coming during the Obama administration about 4 years ago, is even if they came through the ports, again, the Texas Tribune spent a long time down there, and we would see people coming up that had just been smuggled across the Rio Grande, turning themselves into Border Patrol. Eventually, those folks were processed as a family unit, given a notice to appear, and then returned to go back to court or put with sponsors, and the children were again put in the custody of HHS and the Office of Refugee Resettlement. So what's changed now is that those parents are being prosecuted under USC 1325, which is entry without inspection, and the government is saying, look, we're not separating them because we want to be cruel. We're separating them because we cannot put these children inside these detention facilities, these jails, with their parents. That just goes contrary to current law. And I think that the government is also defending itself by saying, look, under the Obama administration, you give somebody a notice to appear, many times they abscond. And that is true. The figures for people that don't show up to their court hearing are relatively high. And another issue is just the fact that asylum cases take so long, years and years in some cases. So those folks are given a work permit and they can move about legally in the United States, which I think is one of the loopholes that the administration has been sort of hammering on and saying that they want to close.
There is an ebb and flow. I was looking at some charts over the last, frankly, last couple of decades, looking at the numbers of people coming over the U.S.-Mexico border. It seemed like the vast numbers were in the 1980s, the 1990s, the kind of ebb and flow that we've seen in the last decade or so. What explains that?
I think what explains the current spike, at least in the last few years from Central America, is the sort of banana republic reputation that it has down there, and the surge in the homicide rates in El Salvador and Honduras. You know, depending on which year you look at, those are either number one or number two with respect to the homicide rate, you know, per 100,000. And that is definitely what's leading the charge up north. Even before the Central American mass migration started, there was an uptick in Mexicans that were coming because, as we all know, Mexico was, and in some places is still, a very dangerous place, especially for folks that are, politicians or activists or journalists. So with respect to Latin America, I think that is the key that prompted this, at least from my coverage area, which is Texas, Mexico, and then somewhat Central America. But again, historically, you know, somebody posted on Twitter yesterday saying, look, you know, when you talk about a crisis in these numbers, you know, remember the quote-unquote Mariel boat lift in the 80s, and those were tens of thousands, if not more, Cubans that were coming in. And, you know, so the United States has been here before, but to get to your point, it just, I guess, depends on the factors around the world and what's driving people and the current politics here and whether or not people see this country as welcoming or not.
We're almost up on the break here, but do we know, once these families have been separated, whether they will be reunited? You told a story about a grandmother. It's a complicated story, but a grandmother who was being detained. Her grandson is in a facility in Connecticut. A really heartbreaking story. But speaking more generally, are people reunited, or is it too soon to tell?
I think it's too soon to tell. You hear, and there's so many stories. I mean, this issue is just being saturated, which is good. I think the more attention that's put on it, the quicker we come to a resolution or some sort of compromise between both sides that everybody can, you know, deem as palatable. But, I mean, there are reports of people being sent back to Central America without being told where their children are. Mm-hmm. The asylum case and the grandmother that you mentioned, again, you know, we're doing our due diligence. I reached out to public affairs in D.C., to ICE agents here in El Paso, to ICE agents in San Antonio, and they're just not forthcoming with information. So that's a complicated case, but there are other stories of asylum seekers being separated at the port of entry. Now, again, to give the government its, you know, a proper defense, they say, look, there are reasons that we separate these families even if they come to the port. But I think what they could do well on their behalf is to explain what these reasons are, instead of saying don't comment, or instead of saying don't listen to the press, and things of that nature.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Julian Aguilar. He's a border affairs and immigration reporter for the Texas Tribune, and joining us on Radio Times to tell us what's happening along the U.S.-Mexico border, the numbers of children that have been detained, separated from their parents. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. Questions, comments, send us an email as well, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Julian Aguilar, who is reporting on the U.S.-Mexico border for the Texas Tribune. And let me play another clip from this one, actually, from the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. This was at an impromptu press conference on Saturday.
The previous administration wouldn't prosecute aliens who entered the country with children. It was a de facto open borders if you came with children. The results were unsurprising. More and more illegal aliens started showing up at the border with children.
From your reporting, Julian, do you think that's true? That because of the U.S. the Obama administration's policy, that inspired essentially more families to cross the border with children?
In my reporting, with my colleague Jay Root and Alexa Uda, who we embarked on this project, the year-long project, in the late 2015 and 2016, we asked people, right? And again, I say this with you know, reminding people that it's a small sample based on the sheer numbers of tens of thousands. But the response, some folks, I don't think the majority did not say, but some folks did say, yeah, I thought if I got here, I would get some sort of a permiso, right, a permit of some sort. But nobody was very specific and mentioned, you know, DACA or the ins and outs of it. I mean, there were some folks that we talked to and said, you know, no. I mean, I can't imagine a lot of 10 or 11-year-old children that are riding on top of a train by themselves, you know, thinking that they're going to get in-state tuition in some university or something. They're just trying to flee for their lives or reunite with their families here. So I don't think the Attorney General, it's fair to say that he's absolutely wrong, that there's been no cases of that. But just how many people and whether those are even half or a majority, I think that's very, very, very hard to tell because, again, what we alluded to earlier is what motivates these folks is different based on where they're coming from. Mainly it's safety, but some of them are what people call economic migrants that are just looking to get work here. And it should be also noted that traditionally the United States labor force employers enjoy looking the other way when it comes to you know, cheap undocumented labor. And until there's a crackdown on that or a conversation about that, you know, I think that's going to be a magnet whether Republicans or Democrats want to admit that out loud as well.
And we should say that the president is meeting with members of Congress sometime later today. Let me play another clip. This is Senate candidate from Texas, Beto O'Rourke, speaking on Sunday. It was at a press at the detention facility at Tornillo, Texas, the place that we have been talking about with our guests. Let's give it a listen.
There are 98 children here right now at the Tornillo tent facility. There are plans to expand capacity to upwards of 4,000 beds. There are a mix of kids who arrived here unaccompanied, didn't have their parents or family with them, and kids who were taken from their family, taken from their parents, literally at the moment that they arrived at this border. We're here for all of those kids, though, and we're also here for America. We're here to define who we are. Either we're a country that takes kids from their parents at a moment that they are seeking safety, at a moment that they're at their most vulnerable and desperate, or we are a country that lives up to our best traditions and in our best interests. And I think that's what we're trying to demonstrate right now.
And Julian, that's something that you referenced earlier. Laura Bush, the former First Lady of the United States, had a op-ed in the Washington Post yesterday comparing the treatment of children in these camps to the internment of the Japanese during the Second World War. What kind of sway does she have in Texas?
She's still very influential, but I mean, Texas politics, especially within the Republican Party, has sort of evolved. Now there's two factions of it. You know, the moderate Speaker of the Texas House, Joe Strauss, he's a Republican from Alamo Heights, the San Antonio area, and he was deemed moderate because he didn't want the House or the legislature to pass the quote-unquote bathroom bill, you know, that restricted bathroom use based on gender identity. He was for a more moderate version of sanctuary cities, and he's the Republican leader of the lower chamber here, and he was actually censured by a couple of Republican county delegations. So I think the former First Lady falls into this camp. Some of the far-right Republicans here had commented as soon as she made that statement saying she doesn't represent the Republican Party, and then whereas moderates would, you know, sort of hit back and say, yeah, actually she does. You guys don't represent the Republican Party. So in the sense that there are still those George W. Bush moderate Republicans out there, she does have a lot of sway. And, you know, again, Senator Cruz yesterday surprised a lot of folks by introducing legislation and speaking out against this policy. Senator Cornyn did the same thing. And these are two gentlemen that have been, you know, a bit behind most of the Trump administration's policies. And I'm assuming they're on board with everything except this one with respect to the separation. And just real quick, if I could know what
sure,
the congressman said in that clip when he said, you know, he was told that 98 folks were in there. That was at the beginning of this rally, and I covered that. About an hour and a half later, he said he had updated information, and that number jumped to 200. But he wasn't sure what the ratio from separated at the border to unaccompanied was. So I just say that to emphasize how fast moving a lot of this information is sort of swirling around, and how difficult it is to really get a handle on these figures and what's going on inside those tents.
Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Gary. He said, today on CBS News, I heard that immigration detention centers are run by private companies. Is that true, Julia?
There are several private companies that have contracts with the federal government. Southwest Key is a nonprofit, and it has it's the one running the shelter down there in Brownsville. And you know, some of these employees that are working inside, I'm sure they go to work and they clock out, and their hearts are broken. Just a lot of these CBP agents and these Border Patrol officials, they say, hey, I'm just doing my job. On the other hand, you get folks like on that radio call that seem to be mocking these children. But a lot of the government says, you know, that we farm out to nonprofits or to the private industries because, you know, it's easier to do that. But what the journalists are, you know, what makes it hard to do our job is that the private companies, for example, the GEO Group, who runs several detention facilities and has very lucrative contracts with the federal government, we can't find a record those because it's a private company. We can't FOIA those a lot of paperwork to see what's going on inside. But yes, to the reader's point, to the commenter's point, there are several for-profits that run these centers, and they make quite a bit of money doing so.
Do we know what the ratio is of staff to children? Do we know if there are doctors there, caseworkers, mental health professionals?
They say, and again, to be fair to Representative Mary Gonzalez, the Democrat, who is 100% opposed to what's going on. I mean, she conceded that what she saw inside, that there were doctors and that there was medical care and caseworkers. Now, the ratio, I'm not really sure, because it would be hard to figure how many would you need for 4,000 unaccompanied minors, right, if it gets to that point, or 1,500 children, including, you know, very, very young children. You know, do they need caseworkers and any legal representation, or do they just need a sort of family figure, a mother or father that they were taken from? I mean, what's the best for their mental health, and how do we decide? So these questions are a little difficult to answer. As we're speaking on the phone, the DHS press office is having a conference call, and they just announced this, you know, maybe within the last hour and a half. So maybe there's some new policy. Maybe, again, they're pushing back on what they say are false reports, but again, this stuff is changing by the hour.
Absolutely, and we'll try to keep our listeners as up to date as we possibly can. Why can't you and other reporters get inside these places?
That's the million-dollar question. I think traditionally it's been hard, though. I will have to say that, you know, under the Obama administration, I'd say I had to go to a Southwest Key facility in the Rio Grande Valley, a smaller facility than what people are talking about now, but I was also denied access in there. I was denied access in December, past December, inside the Border Patrol processing facility here in El Paso. So it's just been longstanding policy, and I think the Trump administration now is either continuing that, and they're definitely ramping it up, you know, with the way they view the coverage and, you know, the folks, the secretary actually telling people not to trust the media. But it's been longstanding policy. The government has always been reluctant to let us go inside, and even if you do are allowed inside, even in the most recent cases, I'm sure you saw that recording and photography and video isn't allowed. So a lot of the images that we're getting about what's going on inside these facilities are courtesy of the federal government, or in some rare and extraordinary cases are leaked out, like the way the Ginger Thompson's ProPublica story, very important story,
yes,
was aired out on Monday.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and we've got another guest joining our conversation. We are talking about what's happening along the U.S.-Mexico border, this new policy of separating children from their parents who are coming here illegally. Julian Aguilar is border affairs and immigration reporter for the Texas Tribune. And here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Laura Benshoff, and she's immigration reporter for WHYY. Laura, nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. And again, to our listeners, to join our conversation, any questions or comments you might have, this is really the story of the hour, if I can put it that way. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I should say that we have a psychologist who'll be joining us around quarter of or so, just to talk about her concern about the effect of this separation policy on children's mental health. Laura, let me get you in on the conversation. Is this policy, is what we're seeing along the U.S.-Mexico border, having any kind of impact on Pennsylvania?
I think it's having an impact everywhere. In Pennsylvania, a lot of public officials, a lot of our congresspeople and hopeful, you know, Senate hopefuls have been weighing in. It's something that's coming up at every press conference. Local officials feel like they need to have an opinion. They need to have a stance. I think right now, Senator Bob Casey is having his own press conference where he's signing on to a Democrats' bill to sort of end this policy at the border. And it's something that I guess there are echoes of the past here mm-hmm. in Pennsylvania. I mean, we were talking about detention centers, and under the Obama administration, when there was this big wave of unaccompanied minors around 2014, he really ramped up family detention, and one of those centers is right here in Berks County. So that's something
the Berks facility, I guess we call it. Yep.
It's the Berks Family Residential Center. And so there's been a longstanding advocacy here against that center and against the practice of family detention. So in some ways, that's just getting translated onto a new target. And right now, because family detention is being talked about in some of these legislative solutions to family separation, you know, I believe the Ted Cruz bill, some of the other solutions that are being bandied about as a part of an immigration package later this week talk about ramping up family detention. That's something that is people in our state are very much aware of and have a long history of sort of grappling with, you know, whether that's a good solution to large numbers of family units arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Right. A lot of controversy and back and forth about that. Julian, do you want to add to that? And are there family detention facilities in Texas?
There were, yes, there were facilities. See, so what happened, again, in 2014, 2015, the families that were turned themselves into Border Patrol were apprehended. They were given a notice to appear in court. They were held together. In some cases, they were adjudicated rather quickly and given ankle monitors, and then they were turned over into the custody of, for example, in McAllen, the busiest shelter there was Sacred Heart, and that was a church, and that's where volunteers would go in, and local governments would provide security, and the Red Cross would go in. So with respect to what happened back then, that's still occurring, and there still are some shelters here for the family units that either got here before the zero tolerance or because for some sort of discretionary reason were not separated. Maybe these are the folks that sought asylum. But so yes, there are some of these family shelters. I don't know of any large facility that's operated by the government or that's has a private contract with respect to how large or to, compared to the size that, you know, the Southwest Key facility is for the unaccompanied minors or the quote-unquote tent city out here in Tornillo, Texas. But I think the families are being kept together in smaller shelters that are run by nonprofits and volunteer organizations.
Let me read some comments that we have here. One from Renee on our Facebook page. The treatment of these people is against the Geneva Convention. It states that we cannot send back people who are in fear of persecution or death. Also, we must treat them humanely as we would our own citizens. A Facebook comment from Anne. This breaks my heart. I've never been so upset and angry with our government. Just a sense of how people are feeling about this. And you can also tell us what you're thinking and feeling as well. Laura, the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, was in Pennsylvania just a couple of days ago. What did he say?
He didn't take any questions. He was speaking to a closed group of state and local and federal law enforcement. So his speech was really tailored to that audience, and he kind of only obliquely mentioned this policy and sort of the controversy around this policy. He mentioned that, you know, we need to enforce laws and that the goal of everything that we're doing now is to send a message. It's to deter people from coming here. You know, I think his quote was something like, we need to tell people, you know, wait your turn, get in line, don't just show up at the U.S. border. And he also spent a long time criticizing the so-called sanctuary city policies that Philadelphia has, because this has been an ongoing sort of back and forth between the Justice Department and cities such as Philadelphia.
Julian, are there sanctuary cities in Texas?
It depends on who you ask. You know, I mean, by ICE's own admission, all 254 counties in Texas, they cooperate with law enforcement when it comes to the detainers. And I know the definition varies between state to state, but at least in Texas, that's the definition. You know, the general term is, you know, a local government that doesn't cooperate with federal immigration officers. But here in Texas, at least the way it's defined in statute by the recently passed Senate Bill 4, is a local government who doesn't allow their jails or their jails, excuse me, their jails or the sheriff's offices to cooperate with ICE on detainers. And every county in Texas, all 254 counties, cooperate, some with a little bit more enthusiasm. Some actually have ICE agents inside around the clock, but others, they let ICE agents come and go, but they usually adhere to at least the 48-hour holding rule that DHS asks of these. Now, with respect to inquiring about immigration status, part of Senate Bill 4 was it didn't require that local police officers everywhere were allowed to ask about immigration status for any reason, whether it's upon just detaining somebody or arresting somebody. And remember, detaining somebody could be for a traffic light or just to question them about a crime. But what the law said is that police chiefs and sheriffs couldn't institute a policy that said you cannot ask about immigration status. So with respect to that, under that definition, because of statute and because of practice with the jails cooperating with DHS, even before this was signed, some people would argue that there aren't any sanctuary cities in Texas.
Interesting. But thinking also about this family separation policy that's come from the Trump administration, we hear Jeff Sessions saying it's a deterrence, it's a way of keeping people from coming to the country. The president blames the Democrats. At one point, the secretary of the Department of Homeland Security said it's not happening. So I think, Laura, and we're about a minute before our second break here, but I think for a lot of people, we don't know what this policy is because it seems like there's a lot of contradictions coming out of the Trump administration.
There are a lot of contradictions, and part of that is because it's not an explicit policy. They didn't just write down, we will separate families at the border. They're instituting a practice of zero tolerance, which is a language that they're using to prosecute parents who cross the border with their children. And by default, that means taking their kids away. So it kind of allows people to say that there is no policy, while at the same time, in practical matter, it is. It is a policy. But yes, it's very confusing, and there's a lot of different messaging happening right now about what is or isn't happening.
And my understanding is that if the president wanted to end this, he could say this policy is done.
That is my understanding as well. I mean, this wasn't a statutory change. This wasn't based on a court ruling. This was a decision that happened top down through the executive branch. And the understanding that I have is he could undo it.
That is Laura Benshoff. She's immigration reporter for WHYY. Julian Aguilar joining us from Texas. He's a reporter for the Texas Tribune. And again, talking about the U.S.-Mexico border and this policy of separating children from families entering the country illegally. 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with Julian Aguilar, who's joining us down in Texas. He's a border affairs and immigration reporter for the Texas Tribune. And here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Laura Benshoff, and she's immigration reporter for WHYY. A question from Tracy. And Julian, let me put this to you. Who is looking out for the safety of the kids in these facilities, not just their legal needs, but making sure that they're isn't bullying and that these children are safely and securely being taken care of. Can you answer that question? Julian?
I'm sorry, you were kind of cutting in and out there. I'm really sorry. Can you repeat that part?
Oh, sure. No problem. Who's taking care of these children? We touched on this earlier, but a listener up here was just concerned about the safety of these children and I guess even the training for people who are supposed to take care of them. Do we know, is there any way to know that they're at least getting some of their basic needs taken care of?
Yes, I mean, according to the government and according to actually the state official that went in there to at least this one facility, there are adults there. There are people that take care of them. Southwest Key used to deal with only unaccompanied minors and family units, so they're pretty well versed at how to take care of these. But I think what we talked about earlier, which is when this is a good thing, obviously. But the what we talked about earlier is are there enough? Are there enough for the numbers of children that are coming in? According to reports, you've seen some reports of other minor children having to help a young girl change her own diaper because there aren't enough people there on the ground. But then, you have the DHS secretary saying these kids are being treated great. They have great medical care. you know, even some online readers are saying they probably have it better inside there than they do in their own home countries. So short answer is yes, the government and these nonprofits and these volunteers, they are providing people to care for these children. But the question is, how well-trained are there and how many are there, and is that going to be enough?
Well, and they're not the parents. I mean, these are strangers, probably well-intentioned strangers with some training, but they're not the parents. Laura, let me turn to you. And there are a number of stories talking about if parents are being prosecuted and put through the legal system, in a sense, and you've got children being held by DHS or Health and Human Services, you've got families in different jurisdictions, in a way, or different bureaucracies.
That's right. I mean, they're kind of under the purview of two different parts of the government. Kids who end up in a shelter and under the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is through the Department of Health and Human Services, they're sort of on one track, and their parents who are going through a federal prosecution are on another track. And I think what a lot of people are raising concerns about is what is the plan to reunite kids and their parents when they are sort of going through these parallel processes? And one that tends to be, as I understand it, much, much longer. You know, I think from what I'm hearing about the prosecutions that the parents are going through, is they tend to be very short. It's a misdemeanor charge for time served, and then you can be deported fairly quickly or removed from the country fairly quickly.
Within a couple of days, maybe?
Right. But for you know, kids who end up in these shelters, they may have more legal protections. They may be entitled to a fuller hearing in immigration court if they have credible fear or something like that, some other grounds for staying here. And that process can take a long time and requires, is often much more successful with the help of attorneys, and then it's coordinating pro bono attorneys who tend to be the people who operate or sort of help out at these shelters. There are some shelters that have federally subsidized attorneys who come in and will do legal counseling for the kids. But it's a big process, and it's very different than what their parents are going through.
Sure. And Hulan, we've heard individual stories of parents being sent back, but their children not going with them. And I guess the question is that the exception, or is that the rule? Or again, is it too soon to tell how this policy is going to work?
I think now it's too soon to tell, but I think the fact that just based on what we've seen just so far in the 2 months since Zero Tolerance was announced in April and then really put into full force a couple weeks after that, is that those are the stories that are being told, is that these parents are being deported quickly with little to no idea of how they're going to get reunited with their children or what's going to happen to their children. And again, with respect to the counsel, to the attorneys, at least in Texas, the immigration attorneys, they do a very, very valiant effort on their part to represent as many of these unaccompanied minors as they can. But they are the first to say they just are not enough resources, because, as I'm sure a lot of people are familiar by now, you know, immigration, when it turns into the civil matter, you're not guaranteed a right to counsel as you would be in the criminal justice system. So a lot of these kids are sort of left in the lurch. And the attorneys, again, going back to what we spoke about earlier on asylum cases, just because they take so long and they're so nuanced, and you know, if you get initially rejected for an asylum claim, you could go through the appeals process and how long that would take. It's just so time consuming to get a lot of legal representation for some of these kids, which I think sort of adds to that question of what's going to happen to them. Are they going to be able to stay? Are they going to be sent back to where their parents are? And do their parents even know where they are when they're asked to leave the country or told to leave the country?
And how do you represent a four-year-old, you know, if there's a language barrier?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
No, I was talking to an attorney yesterday who said it's really hard. You know, unaccompanied minors in the past have tended to be teenagers, people who are a little bit, older, and they have better language skills and they can better sort of represent what their wants and needs are. But that's a different challenge when you're talking about very young children.
We have an email question about where Senator Pat Toomey stands on this. Can you answer that, Laura?
Sure. Senator Toomey appeared on a radio talk show earlier this week, and he said a couple of things. He sort of broadly said he supported the policy. He, in general, has been someone who's favored harsh or tougher enforcement of existing immigration laws and also tightening immigration laws. But he also said, you know, he's not an expert and this isn't a topic area that he needs to know more about, which I think leaves him space to have his position evolve. But, you know, Senator Toomey, the GOP Senate candidate Lou Barletta, who's challenging the incumbent Democratic Senator Bob Casey, they have both sort of been in support of this policy generally.
Interesting. Well, we're going to end on that note. Laura Benchoff, thank you for coming in, immigration reporter for WHYY. And Julian Aguilar from the Texas Tribune. Julian, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you all for having me.
You're very welcome. Well, Dr. Dana Sinopoli is a Philadelphia-based psychologist who wrote a petition calling for the end of the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy of separating children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. More than 9,000 mental health professionals and organizations have signed her letter saying that separating these children from their parents can have lifelong traumatic consequences. The American Psychological Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Physicians, the American Psychiatric Association have also publicly condemned the administration's policy. And we asked Dr. Dana Sinopoli to join us on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I'm going to read just the first two sentences from your letter, your open letter. We would like you to remember what it feels like to be a child, to take a moment and remember how big and sometimes scary the world felt, and how, if you were lucky, the adults in your life represented security and safety. What are your concerns about these kids?
You know, I think that when people are hearing about this, there is a lack of empathy with these children, that we are talking about the news in this disconnected kind of state. And my concern in terms of the effect of toxic stress, and what I mean by that is this prolonged exposure to heightened stress. And we know that actually alters the architecture of the brain. And so we're not only talking about the psychological effects, which include effects on interpersonal capacities, emotional functioning, behavior, and this includes, and this is the architecture of the brain, both changes in the amygdala, which is that fight or flight center, and then also the hippocampus, which handles emotional response. And this is so directly linked to impulsivity and aggression, which really can be linked to both being the victims and the perpetrators of crime. And I want to be really clear that I'm not talking about, you know, this idea that immigration leads to criminality. I think it's a huge disservice that's being put out there. What I'm talking about is the effect of this disrupted attachment and forced separation on these parts of the brain that are connected to aggression and impulsivity.
Well, and let me pick up on a couple of things. There are people, not parents, but there are people who are taking care of these children. Is there anything they can do and say to these children to help mitigate some of this crisis?
Yeah, and, you know, certainly there are mitigating factors so that not all children will experience the full intensity of this toxic stress. And I think the amount of patients that those who are caring for these children, I mean, this is a tremendous traumatic experience. And it's, of course, a compound of trauma that, you know, a Somali British poet, her name was Warson Shire, and she wrote, "No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of the shark." Mm-hmm. And I think we really need to remember why parents are putting their children through this journey, that this is not a cruise for these children or these parents. So this compounded trauma of where they are fleeing, the journey itself, and then to be forcibly separated by their parents is really what we're left with these children.
Well, I listened and watched this ProPublica audio tape. Someone was able to record these children crying for their mommy, their daddy. Yeah. One little girl, I think from El Salvador, apparently had the phone number for an aunt, wanting someone to call her aunt so that she could come and rescue her. And I have to say, if you don't cry listening to that tape, you have ice water in your veins. I mean, this is a very upsetting and difficult situation, obviously. I was also really astonished. Colleen Kraft, who's a pediatrician, president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, went to a shelter where she said the children were not allowed to be held. And I just, my heart just froze. Help us understand what that could mean for a child.
So, you know, that parents, they represent, and attachment figures, they represent this internal state of security. And that is one of the most basic blocks of attachment for the world, this sense of security. And for a child to be in a state of horror and in shock and not to be held or comforted or soothed, it becomes incredibly difficult for them to regulate and soothe themselves in these moments. So it's really difficult for those of us in the mental health profession not to be thinking of this in terms of the systematic traumatization of children. And I think our field is really activated in this way that we need to start calling it out as just this. And Secretary Nielsen, in her press briefing yesterday, was asked point blank how she can deny that this is child abuse. And if you watch her, she doesn't answer the question directly. And I think that's because it's really hard to think about this and support the policy at the same time.
So is this child abuse?
In my opinion, this is at least the complicit agreement of the systematic traumatization of children.
Here's an email from Julia, who says, can you ask a psychologist the effect of our children hearing the news of the treatment or mistreatment of immigrant children, wondering about not children who are separated from their parents, but children who might be listening to the news up in Philadelphia, hearing about what's happening to other children. Is there something parents can do to help that?
That's a really great question. You know, I think what is so necessary right now is empathy, that we talk to the children in our lives about empathy towards these children, and that the younger we can start to talk with children about the way they go out and treat other children in the world, this is where that starts. And I do think there is, you know, I grew up in a family where what was happening in the world was just part of dinner table conversation. And I think there is a way that parents can continue to do that, but in a nurturing and soothing way, so that there is an understanding of what's happening in the world and also allowing their children to feel safe.
We're almost out of time. No, I think that's terrific advice, and we're almost out of time, but I'm also thinking about these children. Let's say they do get reconnected with their parent, maybe after a couple of days, a couple of weeks, maybe even a couple of months. What can that parent do to help that child who obviously has been longing to see them?
Right. And of course, reunification is what we would hope for. At the same time, that does not erase the trauma of being separated at the border. So, you know, for these parents and these family members who are reunited, they have been traumatized themselves. So there is this way of, you know, not only helping these children, but helping these parents as well. And I do still have faith that parents, and it's not faith, actually, I'm going to put it more in what we know about parents, that they will be able to connect with their children during this reunification process. And we have to remember that these parents are human beings, and they are good parents who are trying to help their children live in a safer world.
You have
even by taking them across the border.
You have something like 9,000 people that signed your letter. Did your letter go to the president? Who did it go to?
Right. So we are in the process of printing and sending this out. Our plan is that it will go to Trump, to Sessions, to Nielsen, to Paul Ryan, to McConnell, to Schumer, to McCarthy and Nancy Pelosi. And they will get a copy. What they do with it is up to their own consciences, but they will get a copy.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And that's Dr. Dana Sinopoli. Again, she is a Philadelphia-based psychologist, wrote a petition calling for the end of the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy of separating children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. And something like 9,000 or more than 9,000 mental health professionals and organizations have signed her letter. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. And I'm sure we will carry on this conversation on our Facebook page. Bob Ball's the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.